Hello, I'm Jamie Sanchez. Who are you?
I'm Lauren Fates, and I saw Mokachu. I saw him.
Are you ready for the beat?
I'm ready for the beat.
Welcome back to another episode of the Bebop Beat, Cowboys. We're here with three guests today, and we're really excited to dive into cowboy funk.
Three guests is tied for the most we've ever had in the room. So this is very exciting. Full house. We have our friends today from the Vintage Anime Club podcast. Please welcome Garrett, Dennis, and Kate.
Hey, how's it going?
Hello there.
Hi.
We're so excited to talk with you today because not only were we talking about cowboy funk, you guys also talked about cowboy funk. And what parody? What a coincidence. All the graces from the heavens aligned, and here we are today.
It's like two ships passing in the night, but actually seeing each other, which is great.
But like a bounty hunter meeting a cowboy.
Yeah, we don't do a lot of cross-podcast collaboration. I think this is really our first, and that means there's lots and lots of people with lots of juicy opinions about the same thing that we all love. So for our friends at home who maybe are tuning in to your show for the first time, tell us a little bit about Vintage Anime Club. How long have you been doing this and how did it get started?
So we've actually been doing this for just over 5 years. We started back in 2016, and this was basically a continuation of podcasting from when we used to do a cosplay related one. It just got to a point where we were talking about the same conventions and the same costumes we were working on, and for both Kate and myself and some other friends, it just kind of got a little boring, and we're just sort of all hanging out with other people, drinking, you know, normally, talking, chatting, having those anime opinions, and then it just got to the point of like, why don't we record this? Why aren't we just sitting around having a fun chat about hot anime takes or recommendations on why so-and-so hasn't seen it yet? Which is normally me, because I have a lot of back holes to fill for the anime catalogs and whatnot, and just have a fun time recording with friends, with people, and seeing some of our actual DVDs and seeing if they still hold up, or if we got to Marie Kondo those things away. Who knows? That's how I was able to get friends and everyone else to join, because they're all like, I want to be on this podcast because I have opinions. Also, I enjoy hanging out with you guys and drinking, so... For our double entendre pun, so-called, vintage is not just for how old these shows are, but it's also for lots of wines that we are drinking, too.
Aw, oh, dang. I didn't even get that, as usual. So there's more than three of you normally, yes?
Normally, yeah. We normally record 3 to 4 people, and every now and then we'll get 5 to 6. We have a fun rotating host. We try to get who we can on when they're available, but we also know that we're all adults with real lives. And you can't be on every other week for this.
Yeah, and there's also sometimes when someone's like, hey, I need to be on, I need to talk about this thing. And then sometimes people are like, I just don't care about this one and I'd rather do something else.
Mm-hmm.
That's really smart. Considering that you've recorded 125 episodes so far, I imagine that that kind of keeps the wheel moving, right?
Yeah, just that number blows my mind. I can't believe that we've done so much. Because it really, it's just like a group of friends hanging out, drinking and chatting about anime. Whether it's stuff that we love or stuff that we watched and hated, but we have to just, you know, get out our hot opinions on it.
Yeah, it's fun to see how, you know, not just getting out our hot opinions, but how those opinions have changed over the years to where we can bring in something, be super excited about it. I think a perfect example would be Trigun when we talked about that. And some of us were really excited to bring it in. Some of us were excited to see it for the first time. And we went through it. And after like the first couple episodes, we're like, is this really the show I remember? I remember this being a lot funnier. I don't know what's going on now.
The nostalgia goggles came off.
I definitely felt that way about a semi-recent watch through of Gundam Wing. Just like,
ooh, I feel you. I tried to rewatch it and I haven't managed to make it through it yet because
we're
it's
almost halfway. We're oof. Eventually going to do this for our show. We're eventually going
to
do it.
They are almost halfway. Yeah. I'm having no
part
of that.
We will cover it. Like we tend to try to stick to shorter series and Gundam Wing is like 49 episodes, but oof, that writing is hard to watch now.
It's like prime for reboot. Honestly, I think they'd make lots of money with the 13-episode reboot.
That's true. Although I feel like Sunrise is so dedicated to the classic Gundam timeline, and Gundam Wing did so well in the US, but I don't really know if it was successful enough in Japan that they'd consider doing more in the Gundam Wing timeline.
I think it is still super successful in Japan, as you can tell by how many Gunpla I have bought of just Gundam Wing.
Yeah, but that's Gunpla. But do people care about these characters anymore?
I mean, the suits, yes. The pilots, who knows?
So you're talking about all these great classics. What defines a vintage anime for you? What is your criteria for selecting beyond just the length of a series?
We're going to make a lot of people angry about this, but our first piece of criteria was just anything before 2000, because this is the late 2010s. And in the 90s, most people were talking about classic anime as stuff from the 80s and stuff from the 70s. And much as how I used to listen to a lot of classic rock stations, realizing that, oh no, they're playing 90s grunge on my classic rock station now, it is now at that point. So no longer am I listening to things from the 60s. I'm now listening to things from the 90s. Oh no. So that gripping realization of your mortality knows that vintage is now a sliding scale. We have delved into some shows and some movies that were beyond 2000. Like we've done Spirited Away, which I believe was 2000, in like the mid-2000s. I might be wrong in saying 2004, but I don't bother checking. It's fine. We have also done for a special, we watched and covered Your Name, which was like a 2017 movie, which is excellent. And it was just something we wanted to toss in as a bonus podcast. So anything that's before 2000 is what we would consider vintage, along with stuff that wasn't always available for streaming. So we would just sort of have a lot of this stuff on DVD, sometimes on Laserdisc, sometimes on VHS.
Well, we haven't actually watched any real Laserdiscs because none of us have a player.
We have not, but we do have access to a guy who does have a lot of stuff.
I know, a guy.
We do know a guy who runs a convention and is great.
Yeah, and he actually mailed us a DVD for, what was it?
Urusei Yatsura
Movie 1.
Movie 1, yeah.
Yeah, because that was horribly out of print and we didn't know anyone who actually had a copy, and he came through.
So you guys are basically doing the Cowboy Bebop episode Speak Like a Child, where kind like someone of. Has yes. one like out of date player and you're trying to find like some way, something to put in it, and you know a guy. That's awesome.
Yeah, except nobody's kicking any electronics.
No, we have more respect for technology than that.
Yeah, I think watching that episode again, like back when I first saw it when it was airing on Toonami, I was like incensed that someone would dare kick like an old VCR, like this vintage piece of electronics, and then smoke around it and like stub out a cigarette on it. And then watching it again for our podcast, I was still like, this makes me so angry.
So I think it's pretty clear why you would choose Cowboy Bebop for your podcast. It's the right time period. It's the right significance in your lives. Is it one of your favorites? Like, where does it live on your list of top anime?
Yeah, it is. And it's weird, as you grow older, you realize like when you mention favorites, you have to like pick categories because you find yourself with too many favorites. So Cowboy Bebop is like the favorite in the adult fan service anime, I guess is the best way to put it. It's one of those that for the longest time, it was if you ever had that one friend who swore up and down they would never watch anime, all that dumb Dragon Ball, Sailor Moon shit. I don't want to get into that. Or a parent, or just anyone in your life who spoke like that. You would show them Cowboy Bebop and they'd be like, oh, I think I get it. You know, it was just, it's so well written, so excellently dubbed, you know, which at that time, that was very hard to find. It just fits this perfect bubble. Great to show people who don't know anime. Great to show people who do know anime. It is hard pressed to find anyone who dislikes this show.
So for me, Cowboy Bebop was one of my entry points into anime because I was one of those people who poo-pooed anime as being sort of monster of the week stuff, like what I had seen watching random episodes of Sailor Moon or Dragon Ball Z. And then it wasn't until Toonami came out and was showing anime late at night, and I was in college and had access to Cartoon Network on cable TV for the first time. And I started getting into it, and I thought, wow, this show is really deep. It's really interesting. I've never seen animation used to tell stories like this. This is so cool. And I went to film school, so the film school nerd in me loved how Cowboy Bebop plays so much with different genres and using the same characters in wildly different settings to tell different types of stories. And incidentally, Pierrot Le Fou is one of my favorite episodes because there's so much film school stuff about it. It made me so happy. And it, like, the sound design, the characterizations, the fact that it's taking these characters who we already know so well and putting them in this wildly different context and you think that they can't get out. It's still one of my favorite shows, and it's been wonderful to rewatch it for our podcast now because it's still so good. So it's really sort of transformed my interest in anime back when I first saw it, and then it still holds up. So it is one of those shows that you can show anyone, whether they're an anime fan or not, because it doesn't get stuck in a lot of anime tropes that other people find hard to understand. Like, things that we take for granted as longtime anime fans is like, yeah, you know, main character types are like this, or, you know, the girl is going to be a character like that. And we can take it for granted, where other people are just, they don't understand that shorthand. Cowboy Bebop doesn't necessarily play by those rules, so it can still have like appeal and still, you know, communicate to people who don't understand all of the super anime otaku stuff that we've been steeping in for years now.
For me, Bebop is a like top 10 show. It is one of my favorites. I can't put it in like that top 5 close to my heart favorites because there's just some other ones that are just hit that nostalgia period, have a little bit more sentimentality for me compared to Bebop. But Bebop is one of those that just, you just can't help but not recommend it, can't help but not showing it. I find myself, it's really, really difficult for me to sometimes rewatch things just because of how much, you know, like how little time that I feel like I have sometimes with all of our hobbies and whatnot. So it has been a joy of being able to rewatch this show because it's not something that I got to do for a long period of time. I think it's been maybe 12 to 15 years since I actually rewatched this series. So seeing it again after that prolonged absence has both rekindled that nostalgia for it, along with having a better eye for detail of like, oh, I completely missed that last time. Okay. It is. There is a lot more to the show to unpack than I even remember. So it is a lot of fun. It comes highly recommended. It's going to be one of those that will perennially stay in my collection no matter what video, if we still have physical media to keep format in the future. But yeah, it'll be there somewhere, digitally, physically, what have you. I'll hold on to these Blu-rays until they fall apart. I don't know.
How are we all feeling about not just the Netflix adaptation of Cowboy Bebop that's in the future, but live action adaptations about anime in general? Do we have faith that this can work or not?
I mean, I feel sort of cautiously optimistic. I think Netflix was really smart to drop some, you know, early images of what the people that they've cast look like. I'm totally okay with John Cho's hair as Spike. I know there are some people who would like it to be bigger, but I think the level of fluffiness is about right for live action. And I think announcing Yoko Kanno is going to be involved in composing new music was a really smart move because there were a lot of, you know, Bebop fans who I think were waiting to see, you know, is it going to feel the same as the show that we all love? And having, you know, the same person behind the music, I think is going to go a long way towards getting people on board who want to make sure that the show is going to be protected.
Yeah, because I don't think you want just reused music from the animated series. Like, maybe you can keep Tank like that. Sure, that's very iconic, but I would feel really awkward watching the show, being able to place where this music comes from within the anime and being like, well, they're just copying it now rather than trying to do their own thing. So I'm not sure how to feel about how I would feel about this. So the fact that we are getting new music does like boost my confidence in the show like slightly. I'm still more on the cautiously optimistic side on, you know, a live action adaptation, whether it comes from Japan or comes from America. I'm still pretty hesitant on most live action stuff. Like, there's some that I have enjoyed. As much as I don't want to mention it, I did enjoy the live action Kenshin movies. You know, that's a whole other full on topic you can get later. Since I was just listening to the Pierre LeFou podcast you guys were talking about, I did enjoy the live action Death Note, not the Netflix Death Note, the old like J-drama Death Note. I did find that one enjoyable too.
This, I was about to jump through the Zoom meeting and start finding you like, you like the Death Note movie? What?
not the one that was done by Netflix, but it is on Netflix with the like Japanese actors and whatnot.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm with the rest of you. It's just cautiously optimistic. It seems like they care, you know, again, like getting the music right, getting new music like that. The characters, the actors kind of somewhat look like the characters. We know that's not like their final, this is what we'll look like in the show version, but you can kind of see that they're trying at the very least. And it's all about the law of averages. Like at some point they have to get it right.
Yeah.
Well, if something's going to be good, at least this Cowboy Bebop has such great source material. And I feel like there's so many people in Hollywood who are like us who discovered this show maybe back when it aired on Toonami, or they've discovered Cowboy Bebop over the years and they also love it and they also want to protect it and make sure that a live action version is going to be as good. So I'm hoping for that.
Oh, we are too. So, so much. If only we could watch it now and get a full understanding of what we're... Drop a trailer already. That's all I'm saying.
In the fall, when? October, right. November, December? Who knows?
No, but we did have news to share. You've reminded me. On Twitter, I posted a couple days ago that I think we, this podcast, discovered something new that's coming in terms of paired materials with the Netflix show. I was hanging out on Twitter looking for people to ask on the show, on the podcast, when we reach our like Netflix phase. I found one of the writers of the new live action show, Sean Cummings. And then I Googled Sean Cummings, Cowboy Bebop, and discovered a French bookstore is posting about a Cowboy Bebop prequel novel that's going to be out in November. And that tells me, okay, Sean Cummings is writing on the Netflix show. He apparently also wrote a paired novel to go along with the Netflix show. So it has to be by November. If the merch is coming out that pairs with the show, that's when it has to be. And I think we were the first people to discover this, that there's going to be a book coming along with it.
Lauren Fates, internet sleuth.
Yeah, yeah.
You're connecting the dots.
Yes, Google foo. So anyway, we should get into Cowboy Funk, I suppose, because we're talking about our aspirations for this Netflix show. And for me, Cowboy Funk, I think, still stands as my favorite episode of Cowboy Bebop. I was wondering last week if it would still be true when I revisited it. And yeah, it is. And I really would like to see Andy on the reimagining. I don't think Andy's listed anywhere on the IMDb cast. So if he's around, maybe that's a season two aspiration. But I'd like to see this one done justice. This one tops my list for sure. How do you all feel about Cowboy Funk? Did you like this one?
When I first saw it, no. I was like, how dare this cowboy caricature come in and annoy my boy Spike? I thought Andy was just the worst and super unlikable. And then watching it again, I was like, no, Andy's great. Like seeing Spike like off his normal footing as like the super cool guy who's got all of his stuff together constantly. Like it was great.
Yeah, I have to echo that. First watched this episode long, long time ago. I hated Andy. I hated him with every fiber of my being. And, you know, not realizing, but understanding that they pulled that episode, you know, shortly after it aired. So I really only saw it once. So that feeling never went away because I never got to revisit it. And then doing so for our podcast, I was like, oh, wow, Andy makes a lot more sense. And it went from like my number zero episode that I hated the most to like top five. It's actually, it's a wonderful episode.
In my watch through of this episode, it was cemented as one of the top three episodes of the show for me. I absolutely love all the comedic timing. And that's really what makes Andy's character so hateable and so likable at the same time. And it occurred to me that we have a name for this kind of person now. Andy is a fuckboy, plain and simple, all around. Gotta hate him, gotta love him. There's just so many aspects to it where you can really see Spike seething. And why is it? He's rich, he's happy, and he's just fucking around. So
I'm glad you are on that side because I brought that up too.
And we had a similar conversation.
We're like, Andy's not really a himbo, though he does have himbo-like properties. I'm like, is he a fuckboy? And no one really would agree with me when I brought that up. So thank you, Jamie.
100% fuckboy. In fact, so the Cowboy Bebop wiki details some aspects about like maybe what inspired Andy's character. And one of those inspirations was Owen Wilson. And potentially, I can't confirm or deny that. That's just the wiki.
Personally, I want to deny because Shanghai Noon came out like a year or two after Cowboy Bebop. So
what if it was the other way around? Like Owen Wilson saw that episode and was like, I like Andy.
I would agree with that.
The writer of Shanghai Noon saw Cowboy Bebop and then decided, what if I paired him up with like an Asian actor who does kung fu?
Let's put that out there instead. I want those vibes.
Well, and then I was watching the show. I'm like, who else could Andy be portrayed by? And Chris Pratt came to mind too. And I'm like, no, that's another himbo. I can't do that. And then I think I landed somewhere along the lines of Andy Samberg. I think he would make an excellent Andy portrayal in a season two of the Netflix live action because he's confident, he's kind of a shithead, and he really lands his comedic timing.
That's very good.
I'm just imagining the Brooklyn Nine-Nine version of Andy. Like, it fits. It's almost perfect.
Exactly. So I'm curious, though, what are your interpretations? If you had the opportunity to cast Andy, who would you pick?
I wanted Nathan Fillion, mainly because, yes, Firefly Serenity, but also if you happen to listen to him on Thrilling Adventure Hour, he plays another space cowboy type person named Cactoy Jim, and he comes across also as being a know-it-all, being very smug. He's actually a really good guy, but he irks the main character of that radio show, Sparks Nevada, Marshall on Mars, to no end, where he's just like, he's too perfect and I hate him, but everyone else loves him and I can't do anything about it. So I feel like Nathan Fillion can portray that comedic timing. Also, he's about the same age as John Cho, so I feel like it would work. And I just want more Canadian space cowboy in my life. That's all I want.
The fandom has pointed out Nathan Fillion a couple of times. I've seen a couple of posts about that. And I'd be all for it because I remember him as Captain Hammer. And that line that he walks between this is a person who is a hero, thinks of himself as a hero, and is seen by many others as a hero, and yet is a total fuck up. I think he can do that really well. And I totally agree that he's age appropriate for John Cho.
So I have a complete stunt casting idea, and it's Cal Penn. Like, let's reunite Harold and Kumar.
Ooh. Oh.
That would be fun. Okay. I would like that take.
That's just funny. That's great.
That would be interesting.
If it happens, we know who they stole that from.
Yeah.
Yes, I would just like to put this idea out there onto the internet in case anyone is listening who has casting power like that.
And then we have Jet with his hippie wig in the background.
Down in a couple of sliders at the party.
I also would just want to put in a vote for the voice actor himself. It's Darren Norris, who plays Cosmo, the Fairly Odd Parents, like fairy godfather. And he has the look. They don't use him in live action very much. And in fact, the Fairly Odd Parents live action, he is going to be animated. But I think that guy, if you put a cowboy hat on him, I think he'd look great. And it would be the kind of Easter egg that I think anime fans are looking for. One of my big fears about the Netflix show is, especially because of timing related to John Cho's injury and COVID-19, they might have eliminated Easter eggs or the opportunity to have Easter eggs, like bringing in the voice actors to New Zealand or something. And man, Darren Norris, that would be a nod for sure.
That would be pretty cool. I also would agree on, like, we got to get some of the vocal cast, both Japanese and English, to just be somewhere in the background, you know, at a bar. Maybe you can have Steve Bloom and Bo Billingsley be two out of the three old guys who hang out around at the bar every now and then.
I think they might object to being cast as the old guys because they're not that old.
Bo wouldn't. Bo wouldn't. I'm confident Bo wouldn't. We've had so far Wendy Lee, Bo Billingsley, Steve Conti. We've had them all on this show. And if they're in the Netflix version, they have done a fantastic job of not turning that hand. They've been saying some really like longing and even mournful things about like, gosh, we sure wish. And if they actually show up on screen and they knew all along, I'm going to yeet my computer into the sea.
That's the power of the NDA right there.
Acting. Never trust an actor, right?
Yeah.
I want to go back to something Garrett said about the episode being pulled. So Cowboy Funk begins with, unfortunately, a pair of Twin Towers being bombed. We kind of start in the middle of a story. Spike is tracking down a serial bomber, and the bomb has already been planted by the time we kind of catch up to Spike. The guy who put down the bomb is dressed as a security guard. He's ready to make his exit, and Spike stops him. There's some like dad jokes about hotel prison. It's really lighthearted, all things considered. But because the topic of this episode is literally two towers that get blown up right at the beginning, this did get taken down from public viewing for a very long time. I'm not actually sure if they're showing it now. I imagine probably yes, because it is on the Blu-rays. But yeah, yet another instance of Cowboy Bebop airing visuals of terrorism that unfortunately were just ill-timed in regards to American history. And this is like the third or fourth instance of it at this point. Our bounty this week is Ted Bauer, aka TB, the Teddy Bomber, worth 3 million wulongs.
So Spike enters the scene very cool, calm, collected, and ready to nab this guy. And little does he know, everything's going to go sideways when a horse flies through a window and appears in front of him, ready to nab him. We learned that Andy is one of two feared bounty hunters in the solar system, along with Spike himself, and that Andy is a total moron.
Yeah, and not feared because they're particularly competent or like they're going to get you, but because of like collateral damage. Teddy Bomber seems afraid of these guys because they're like chaos demons.
They're going to end up in the hospital.
Yeah, a man's going to come through the window with a horse. It's not about being caught or going to jail.
Yeah, their track record, especially for the Bebop crew, is not great when it comes to catching villains and bounties unharmed.
Yeah, or alive.
Or alive,
basically. Yeah. Like we have seen them lose out on so much bounty money just because they couldn't keep the target intact.
And it's a wonder that these people are always starving on the ship.
Yeah, and we do see that Spike had like a whole load of groceries. So he's like, yeah, I'll just pick up this cool 3 million bounty like after I get done with the grocery shopping.
Great detail from this scene. A couple of other details that I caught. The watch, the smiley watch on Teddy Bomber's wrist. This show does a great job tracking time. The time actually changes pretty much in pace with the cartoon. So he pulls it out and we see the watch at 5:02, at 5:06, and again at 5:10. We also know that it's charged by a Ritchium battery. The first Teddy does not blow up because Spike pulled the ignition pin out, but the Teddy Bomber warns him there are more bears. There's a dub versus sub difference here that I really enjoyed. Spike, in this like calmness that you mention, he just kind of says, well, you'd be killed too. Why would you ignite these bombs? In the dub, Teddy Bomber says, nobody lives forever. In the sub, he says, I love them to death, which is kind of a cutesy, like affectionate way of speaking about his teddy bears, which is darkly adorable, in my opinion.
He reminded me a lot of Eelman from when Faye was nabbing the other bomber that we met earlier in the show.
So Andy's interference here does, in fact, let the Teddy Bomber get away and results in the building being blown up, which I get the impression wouldn't have happened if Spike had stayed in control. But the wildest part and the reason we all hate Andy is that as the building goes up, Andy says, "That was close." It wasn't close. The disaster happened, buddy. Like, the worst case scenario occurred. You jerk.
Yeah, this is like really the first point that the show makes a lot of, this point that Andy is the protagonist of his own story in his head. Like, he is the most important person involved in any situation at any time. So as long as Andy is fine, everything's turning out just great.
I did enjoy how much English the Japanese voice actor threw in. It is great comedic timing and stuff too, when the building blows up and he goes, "Oh shit." And it's like, well, yep, that is universal in whatever language you're watching it in.
I've heard to that point that Andy is supposed to be making fun of Americans, or like stereotypical American culture in a lot of ways. And his English exclamations are a part of what makes that clear. And I think that parody would be harder to get if we're listening to it in English in the first place. There's no real replacement for that like linguistic gag that keeps getting inserted.
Yeah, I'm glad that there's only a slight southernness like to his accent while he's talking in English, while Darren's talking, because it could have gone full, you know, cowboy, a bad John Wayne impersonation, or a bad Clint Eastwood, but it's very reined in, and the performance really lets him shine just, you know, with his normal voice, with, you know, a nice little southern drawl that helps fit the whole detail of, yes, this is an actual literal space cowboy.
I agree, because then the joke isn't at the expense of like southern people, but the joke is at the expense of rich white guys. This guy has a bad case of affluenza and has bought his way into a career that a lot of other people really suffer over. And that becomes the punchline, and I appreciate that way more.
I also wanted to point out that it didn't appear to me, at least in the Japanese, not that I speak fluent Japanese at all, but that the voice actors weren't trying to replicate, say, an Osakan accent, which is typically what voice actors do when they're representing more like southern voices, so to speak. Notably, we have Osaka from Azumanga Daioh as a representation of that artistic choice.
He's just a big old Western fanboy. He's a cowboy weeb.
He's a reverse weeb.
And that becomes apparent in the next scene when Spike is trying to explain why he showed up without groceries and completely injured with horse hooves on his back. And neither Faye nor Jet believe him. They think he's just playing it up. It's a little too ham-fisted. And that Jet would believe him had he not given this fictional character, so to speak, a full cowboy getup. We soon discover through Ed searching that no, in fact, Andy's a real thing. He joined the YMCA and was kicked out because he was a nuisance to others. He's also just this chaotic storm of destruction, and that this kind of cements in our minds the dichotomy between Andy and Spike, where the Bebop crew immediately sees these parallels between the two of their personalities.
I love the dynamic in this scene, because throughout the entire show, we always see it's either Spike and Faye kind of being the unruly children, with Jet being the, you know, the very tired, getting too old for the shit father, or we see Jet and Spike getting annoyed at Faye and her antics or her spending or what have you. We rarely ever see Faye and Jet get on Spike's case. Ed is done so perfectly well here that without missing a beat, they're just like, nah, it's fake. You know, it could have been better though, a samurai, and then that pays off later. But they're just going back and forth, having this really fun relationship that we seldom see from them. And the fact that Faye is projecting so much that she just believes that Spike, you know, wasted all the money gambling, doing something she would clearly do.
This scene is very precious because they're also physically working on costumes in the background. Faye has her masquerade mask, and Ayn walks by wearing Jet's wig. At first, I thought Jet was sewing his shirt for the party, but somebody on Reddit called to my attention the fact that the shirt he is like mending in his hands is yellow. I think he's actually fixing Spike's shirt.
Yes.
And that's really adorable. That's really nurturing. And it is very parental for him to be scolding Spike, but still in that moment, caring for him and cleaning up after him.
So this is the moment we learn that Spike, his slight annoyance has turned into utter obsession. And now he wants to seek out Teddy Bomber, not for the sake of the bounty, but to re-encounter Annie and his incompetence.
I have the weirdest catch from this scene before we go to the masquerade. So, Jamie, you were talking about how on the screen they read that he was in the YMCA, he was kicked out. I paused my video to see what was actually said on the screen. It looked like a lot more text than Ed was saying out loud. So I'm going to read some stuff, and it's going to sound really wild, and then you tell me if you can figure out what happened here. On the screen next to Andy is the following resume. Retirement from Sakai Corporation Limited. Participation in the Gate protest movement. Certified to be in the military action of National Defense Corps. Issue of official statement of HDMC. Taking up the top of HDYC with giraffe.
Production shortcuts.
Yeah, you found it. So I spiraled for like 5 minutes thinking there's some sort of like backstory that links Andy to the characters from Sympathy for the Devil or something. Not true. They just took Zebra's information and pasted it into this spot. And it's a production shortcut that I think in its time was probably very reasonable because the like resolution of the way we were watching this show, we never should have been able to read this. But now on our giant televisions on the remastered Blu-ray, you can get a close-up enough view of what's going on here, and it's recycled text.
That's wild.
And that's the first. Like, we've seen other places where they've taken the time and effort to actually, you know, write out other backstory or, you know, document full chess games. And this is where they cut the corner. I'm wondering what happened from a production standpoint that they had to rush that.
It's especially noteworthy in this episode because I believe there is so much high quality animation. There are so many original facial expressions and body movements. Maybe they just had to put the budget elsewhere.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I've seen a lot of cases where an episode of an anime might have some real shortcuts taken, and then you get a fight scene or something partway through, and you can see like that's where all the budget went. So something like this, you know, resume screen for Andy's background that they never expected people would be able to read the text on decades later. They were just like, yeah, we'll just pull something and maybe we'll fix it later. And then it never got fixed later.
We lead into the next scene, which is the Bebop crew attending a masquerade where they anticipate Teddy to show up and blow the heck out of this building. I was a little put off by Spike's manspready, but hey, you do you. And we also get introduced to Ted wearing his teddy bear costume. And like no one will understand or see him. He'll just blend in invisibly. No threat here. The whole of this scene kind of cements things in for me when I know it's immediately followed by the movie, which is also about being in costume, about Halloween. And it's kind of funny to see these characters paralleled between that. If you were to, say, watch this episode and then watch the movie sequentially, you get this costume vibe or like these heightened sensibilities. Also, two terrorist plots in a row.
It also just puts it in a place in time. Like this masquerade could be a Halloween party because apparently if it's right before the movie, it's that time of year. That's cool.
And I don't think it was meant that way from a production perspective. I don't know if it was written as such where they knew that's where they would place the movie in, but there are a lot of clues to tell us that no, the movie does fall between this episode and the one that follows.
Did you notice that the piece of tech that they're using to track where the bomb is has the pin that Spike pulled just taped to it? Somehow that's how the technology works. Like we just taped a piece of the bomb to this walkie-talkie and now it totally finds bombs. What?
I mean, Ed works in mysterious ways. We can all agree on that. They got a computer running out of a cardboard box, so I will buy into it as long as Ed's still there.
Also, understanding how Ed discovers what Teddy Bomber's targets are and they figure out where he's going to be next. Like, I can believe that Ed would say, here, this is how you track him. He's going to be at this building, but not really explain how they got to that conclusion. because it doesn't necessarily have to involve that trigger pin at all. It could just be, oh, well, based on where he's targeted before, this is the obvious next place he'll be.
I love that. I love the idea that Ed just sent them out into the world with a device that supposedly works and does absolutely nothing. That's such an Ed thing to do.
Do we agree that Jet's hippie, like, love and peace moment is a Trigun reference, or are both of them just equally referencing, like, hippie culture in their own way? The literal, like, the world is made of love and peace, it just really raised my eyebrow about the timing of this show.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's too close to be a coincidence. They're like, I don't know. I really also love, in this particular moment, when I saw this on Toonami, Jet was just wearing a shirt and doing his little hippie thing. When we recently watched it, I watched it on Hulu. Yeah, that's a pot shirt. And when I saw it, I was like, wait, is that just something I don't remember because I was a child and didn't know what that was back then? Or was it that they knew children would be watching this, so got to take that out? And I'm thinking now it's the latter. I just love the little things that show that, oh, won't someone please think of the children moments, even with something like Cowboy Bebop.
They definitely took the time to digitally edit a peace sign on his shirt instead of a pot leaf.
I love that Watanabe made the choice to put a pot leaf on that shirt instead of a peace sign, because the peace sign would have made sense, but the pot leaf is much more subversive.
Shout out to our girl Faye, who absolutely, I think, is trying to make a pass at Andy during all of this. I don't think it's just an act. The comedic timing when they're looking at the computer together and they realize that this guy is actually a rich heir, it is only after she hears that she says, oh, and he's quite handsome, he's cute. It's after she hears that he's rich. And so when she gets the opportunity to be on an elevator with him, she's asking about his horse and, like, laying it on really thick. He's not the bounty. There's no motivation to get closer to this clown other than maybe on the side, Feifei's just trying to get that dollar. Like, I think she goes home with him for her own reasons. And here in my adulthood, I'm like, yes, get it. That's a queen.
Oh, for sure. That is definitely what's going on.
Yeah, it's a great juxtaposition from when she almost did a spit take on seeing a horse come out of an elevator to, you know, asking her, hey, so tell me about your horse. And just not realizing as a child that, oh, she spent the night at Andy's, eating that what looks like awful, awful stew.
In that gaudy spaceship. I'm judging the spaceship, though. Let's on record that spaceship is gaudy as hell.
Yes, definitely.
No arguments here.
That's his whole aesthetic, just gaudy.
To roll back a little bit, we end up having this opportunity where Teddy Bomber is captured once again, but Andy comes onto the scene, pretty much messes everything up, explosions go off, and now there's an utter panic among the costume party's guests. People died. There's no way around this. Like, this building is messed up beyond belief. And Andy finds his exit. Faye jumps on that horse. She's running off into the distance. Teddy also, like, steals a car. There's a big chase going on. No one cares about these people in this tower. That's kind of upsetting.
I mean, you speak about people dying. Spike and Andy completely forgetting about Teddy and just start having a gunship horseback firefight in the middle of the city with explosions going off. Like, people died this day just so they could not even have a petty grudge, because it wasn't a grudge at that point. It was just annoyance.
This is one of my favorite scenes in the whole episode. Side note, the license plate of the car that is stolen is AU2878. I couldn't immediately find that being a reference to anything, but in the past, we did see a Star Trek reference on a license plate. So if anyone at home finds something significant there, please let us know. But I love the animation here of Andy emerging on his horse, like, out of the smoke, like this incredible sentinel, like, he's coming for you. And Teddy Bomber gets a look of fear on his face because he thinks he's caught. He's intimidated by this. And then Andy just rides right past him. It is hilarious. I laughed out loud, and I think I will laugh every time I see that.
Round of applause to Keiko Nobumoto, who wrote this episode, and is my ongoing theory that this is why Watanabe's works are good. She just has a way with writing. In this episode, much like Ballad of Fallen Angels, there's no wasted scenes. Everything about it contributes to the story that comes after. And there's this heightened sense of comedy that builds throughout the episode until its finale.
The main song that comes up over and over again in this episode, in my mind, I was referring to it as Andy's theme, but it's actually called Go Go Cactus Man. My question about Go Go Cactus Man is whether it is literally in the world or if it's just background soundtrack. And I think the answer might be both, but I'd like to hear from you all. I get the impression that people hear the whistling. Before Andy even bursts through the window, Teddy Bomber's like, oh, no, like he can hear it. We don't physically see Andy's like lips whistling though. So I just think once Andy's on the scene, it transitions into being background music. But do you guys think people hear this song?
It certainly seems like they hear it. Also, what do you think about the theory that the horse is whistling?
I love it.
Oh, that's why he's kept around. He's very talented.
No, this horse is actually the true talent behind Andy's myth. Like this horse who has no problem getting on elevators, being around explosions,
playing
being
chess.
Around crowds of unfamiliar people. Yeah, and apparently he's a great chess player too.
Yeah, we had this conversation as well, and we kind of together decided that, you know, Ayn is the data dog. This must be a data horse. Like, there's no other way to explain how smart this horse is.
He could afford one, too. Like, he paid top dollar to have the best horse for his bounty hunting.
What if this horse has a Bluetooth speaker built in?
I appreciate the thought, but I also want to, like, what if Andy paid a whole, like, crew of people to work behind the scenes to make him look this awesome? What if there's just a dozen crew, you know, how they say with Beyonce, it's not she put in the time and the effort, it's like, two dozen other people every day to make her look that beautiful. What if in this entire time, there's just people behind the scenes and they know what they're doing and this guy just keeps fucking up?
I like this theory. It's something almost like Mysterio from Spider-Man Far From Home, where he's got a whole crew of people whose job it is to make him be, you know, the hero that he thinks that he should be. So someone's there with the Bluetooth speaker, maybe hiding in a bush playing the song.
So as much as I don't think that's canon, it's what I believe is true now, because you could track it so far. Like, it's either him or his rich daddy. I could see it being his daddy paying money as well. But how does he have a successful stew franchise when it's pretty clear that the stew tastes terrible and it's not a good product? So his daddy's like buying up all the stew to make him feel like he has a successful franchise. I think this has legs.
There's a point where Andy's serving the stew and he tells Faye that it blazes a trail. And that is a euphemism for flatulence if I've ever heard one.
One thing that struck me this watch through, because it is just recent history, is here in Chicago, up until very recently, we had a public figure of sorts called the Dreadheaded Cowboy. And he was an actual man with an actual horse named Nunu, and he would show up at protests. And the city loved him. He was an icon. And when it came to the census, he was hired to be like the official Chicago mascot of the census, and he was much beloved. And then one day last September, he brought his horse out on the highway and ran his horse for 7.5 miles on the highway. And I believe he got arrested for injuring the animal and putting poor Nunu in danger by running this horse on like the freeway. And so my understanding is they weren't sure if Nunu was going to make it, but he did survive. And the Dreadheaded Cowboy is not a thing anymore because that was a bad care for horses. And that real man was on my mind through this entire episode. I'm sure it was not anything that was actually thought about during the production of this show, but me being like, oh, in real life, that horse got taken away, but this dude's jumping through windows and running down streets. It's actually quite bad for that animal. And it made Andy all the more hateful to me. I also hate to invoke this name, but the gaudy, horrible looking ship that they were on did remind me of some photo shoots I've seen of the places Donald Trump likes to live. Donald Trump loves gold statues and gold paint and gold embellished stuff. And he does photo shoots in these hideous, like, gold environments inside his homes. And it's been described as a poor man's idea of what rich people are like. And that is Andy's taste as well. It is a poor man's idea of what a rich person lives like. I should buy thick carpets and gold bathtubs and just a bunch of decor because that's what rich people do. It's like he doesn't have taste other than wanting his environment to look expensive, even if it doesn't match.
Agree.
Definitely. And Donald Trump was, you know, a sort of celebrity figure back in the 90s. So I can totally believe that if they were looking for inspiration for gaudy rich people with more money than taste, like he, you know, is someone that they could have pulled from.
Oh, for sure. And it would have been funnier back then because we didn't deal with a fascist presidency. So it just would have been, here's an American TV host or here's an American businessman that we can base this character off of. And I actually really like that theory for inspiration in the event that Andy was supposed to be an overall commentary on American culture. If this is what a rich American is supposed to look like, who would you look to back then? Huh.
The scene where Andy and Faye are back on the ship and they're talking and she asks him, why are you a bounty hunter? What are you doing this for? And he says, because it suits me. He's clearly in it for some kind of flashiness or a thrill of the hunt kind of thing, but he's just not there. He's not the original thing. And that seems to be why Spike is so pissed off, right? You're just a facsimile of what people think bounty hunters are, which we have seen in previous episodes of the video game where the people think bounty hunting is this glamorous profession where you get all the bounties and you live lavishly. And that's not the case.
Yeah, he wants to play at being hero. And yes, that does irk Spike a lot. But we also see that he either has some smarts or has a crew that has some smarts because we do see that he's a capable fighter. And we do see that he does figure out Teddy Bomber's plans every now and then. He just can't execute them up to the end, unfortunately.
So speaking of Teddy Bomber, he is thwarted three times, technically. Spike ends up arriving to the third bombing site, or what Ed presumes is the third bombing. It's City Hall, because the order of the tallest buildings, that would be the third building. And he's not there for Teddy at all now at this point. He's there to punch the shit out of Andy. He wants to get a piece of him. He wants to prove that, no, you can't treat me like garbage. No, you weren't here first. I'm the person who gets all this. And that's a real ego trip coming from Spike. We don't see him this way in other parts of the series.
I think this is because Andy has really rattled Spike. Like, Spike is now sort of questioning who he is as a bounty hunter. Like, I don't think we've seen this level of introspection from Spike before. Spike seems to be usually pretty confident in who he is and what he can do and what he's good at. And then here comes Andy, who foils all of his well-laid plans. Everyone says he's too similar to Spike, and Andy is just an awful person. So I wonder if Spike is starting to think, like, is this how I come off to other people? Am I actually a terrible person? I mean, maybe I'm putting thoughts into Spike that aren't actually there. But I do like this idea that Spike is extra rattled because he does recognize some similarities with Andy and he hates it.
There's this aspect to Spike's relationship with Andy that appear like a rivalry, right? And towards the end, before they kick off the final fight, Spike says, "You're a person I can never forgive," which is a very Japanese response to a rivalry. But that doesn't in any way overshadow his rivalry with Vicious. And I found that really fascinating this watch through, right? This has nothing to do with Vicious whatsoever. Andy just hits them in the same kind of spot that's more comedic, but not lighthearted at all. He has the same kind of bloodlust in this aspect.
Before we get into the final kind of confrontation here, one other thing that really struck me this watch through is that the Big Shot show is an avenue where they will read terrorist manifestos. Like, I know it's just for the punchline. it's a masterful stroke on the part of Cowboy Bebop that they actually had me feeling sorry for a serial bomber by the end, because he clearly had something to say and they wouldn't let him say it. I felt for him, and I was troubled that I felt for him. But one of the instances of this is that Punch and Judy are just like happy to read his letter on the show. It gets cut off, but I couldn't help but think about our modern era and during acts of tragic mass violence. There's all this analysis over like, why do people do it? Did they want attention? What were they trying to tell us? And it's actually not a common practice to publicly share manifestos or like motivations, because there's this thought that it will inspire other criminals to act. And I started to wonder if Big Shot like makes more crime, because you could end up on Big Shot and you could be on television if you become a big enough criminal and they'll read your manifesto. It got me just in a really dark place, is all I'm trying to say.
So before we roll into the final fight, do you think this episode portrays Spike and Andy's rivalry well? Or do you think that perhaps there's just something left to chance? Like, why didn't they make more episodes with Andy in it?
I think it wasn't as, for me, it wasn't as much as the rivalry between the two, but the fact that Andy brings out the absolute worst in Spike. And I feel like it fits best of just being a one-off. Maybe if the series was longer, bring him back for like that part deux. But for the length of the series, I think it was perfect to just be a one and done.
Yeah, I feel like this episode functions as a good, it's a lighthearted take on Spike's personality. And the logic behind how things work in this episode is more similar to Looney Tunes than anything else. And I can almost think of Spike as like Bugs Bunny, where he's always the cool one. He always knows exactly what to do and how to get other people's goat. But, you know, there's the occasional Looney Tunes episode where Bugs Bunny gets bested, or he's on the run, or like he, you know, he's not the cool one for once. And this is that episode for Spike. And if you contrast this like with his fights with Vicious, like he's also evenly matched with Vicious, except those episodes, it's a much more serious context. Like, even though I'm sure Spike is willing to fight Andy to the death because he hates him so much, as an audience, I don't think we ever really expect that Spike is in real danger of actually dying here. He's just going to get his ego wounded, if nothing else.
I would agree with you there, specifically because of how late this episode comes. They could have done this episode mid-series or at the beginning, but it is very clearly slotted in this spot for a few reasons. One, the story is coming to a natural conclusion, and we will see a rivalry end at some point. But two, the comedic timing of, hey, and also Andy, didn't you know about this famous bounty hunter that is exactly like you? Why did it take you X number of years to figure this out? And I love it. Chef's kiss.
I'm really happy that we get to see Onyx the horse run away a little bit, like get out of the way before the fountain blows up, kicking off this big fight. I would have been really worried, and that the animators made sure to include that was very kind. Teddy Bomber traps Spike and Andy in an elevator that, when it reaches the top, will meet a bunch of the cute little bears in yellow bandanas and will explode. He tells them, enjoy the rest of your lives without regret. Both of our quote-unquote heroes have thought ahead and gotten to the scene in advance, but their actions canceled each other out. They both reverted the elevator code, meaning the elevator was back to the way it started and they couldn't fix it. They couldn't get out. And I like Dennis's earlier point that Andy actually is smart in some ways. Apparently, Andy did solve this problem. It's just that Spike unsolved it. And once that tool was used and they couldn't go back to it, there's a total meltdown. Andy's shooting off a gun inside the elevator. They're screaming. And it's Spike who opens the top of the elevator and they can climb out. But there's no calm, like, let's unite together and save our lives. They are kicking and thrashing and pushing on each other's faces and doing the slapstick routine to the point where, for a moment, you do think they died.
It's like a Negaverse version of Spike. I love it that all of their energy, equal and opposite each other, just canceled each other out.
The Teddy Bomber says that they were brave in death. Like, actually, they were two brave young men. And I even thought that was a comedic line. The way that assholes can die and then everything that is said about them in the news is like, actually, Steve Jobs was a great businessman. They like play at that here. They're like, those two jerks, they were all right. Because he thinks they're not going to answer to it. So he's safe to say something like that. It's just, to your point, Jamie, every moment, like not a wasted line. Even that was hilarious. We see Faye behind Teddy Bomber do that punch that is from Tainted Donuts, as a lot of this is. And Jet and Faye, I guess, did decide to pursue this bounty. Do you guys think they pursued it because they wanted the money after all? Or are they there to save Spike? Do they know that Spike is in a bad way?
I personally believe they were there for the money.
Same.
I don't think they had real concern for Spike. They've seen him get out of so many like tough spots where he should have died. I feel like at this point, it's like, he'll be fine. And if not, if that's how he goes out, oh well.
Meanwhile, Jet and Faye got caught up in the explosion in that building. So they have a bit of a personal reason now to go after Teddy Bomber. And hey, he's worth $3 million, which is not chump change. Like, we've seen them work hard for bounties of much less.
So what do you think? 60-40 Faye for the split? 70-30.
Well, Faye actually punched him, so I'm pretty sure she's going to go 70-30.
She's going to drop him off, too, so I think she gets to basically keep whatever she wants. It's up to her to stand by her word and give a share to Jet.
If Jet is smart, he'll go with.
Spike and Andy have their big final showdown, and again, people died here. This is what I've really noticed this watch through. This is a beautiful set, aesthetically. There's these burnt, decimated offices, and there's chairs and desks and piles of documents, and it's beautiful. But this just happened moments ago. There should be, like, charred corpses in this set, and thank goodness we don't see that, but I was pretty wigged out knowing they were having their little play fight over a tragedy.
The only solace I can have is that Teddy Bomber does say he only blows up things and doesn't kill people. But I mean, you're right in that there is definitely some collateral damage somewhere. He cannot account for a random custodian or what have you who happens to be there, or whatever debris falls around among the unsuspecting crowd below. Who knows?
How could he possibly guarantee that nobody died at that party? That's impossible to guarantee.
Exactly. He cannot.
I mean, he believes he guarantees it. He believes that's what his actions are, but people died.
Yeah.
There's no way around it.
The only way I can sort of accept the visuals of what we're seeing is like basically going on the theory that this episode operates on Looney Tunes logic. So whatever happens, whatever got destroyed, it wasn't that bad. Like, no one who, you know, didn't deserve it got punished for all of the destruction that we saw. Because otherwise, like, it does raise too many uncomfortable questions about what actions are our quote-unquote heroes taking? You know, can we still call them heroic after watching them, you know, either stand by or be helpless in the face of or even cause this kind of crazy destruction?
I was not expecting superhero movie discourse, yet here we are.
I love the Looney Tunes analogy, though, because a lot of this animation, the facial expressions are so exaggerated that seeing this last battle as maybe a Wile E. Coyote v. Roadrunner experience actually colors it the right way for me. Spike's fist collapses the top of a whole building, and the way Andy is like falling in the wreckage. And there's an earlier moment too where a wood plank like bounces Spike up in the sky. I keep thinking, oh, they're dead, but they're not. If they're actually just Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner, those characters never die either, and they fall off of plenty of cliffs.
So that leads us to the end of the episode. Andy gives up. He believes that Spike's punch has more will in it than he'll ever have. Therefore, he is the true cowboy. And he says the line. He says, "See you, space cowboy." We get the line, yes.
We also get the look from Spike of like, did he just say that?
And we cut to Spike back on the Bebop saying, you know, Andy wasn't such a bad guy after all. You know, he was just out of his league. He couldn't do anything about anything. And he saw who the real cowboy was. And he's chomping down that son of a gun stew, and they have hundreds of cans of it, and they'll be eating it for weeks. And I get the feeling that Spike is kind of chummy with Andy now. He's okay with it. If they were to meet once again, they could be friends.
Oh, definitely. Well, he's seen, like, Andy has acknowledged his superiority as the true cowboy. So, and Andy literally hung up his hat. He gave his hat to Spike, who immediately gave it to Ed. Like, Spike's authority as a true cowboy bounty hunter, you know, is now unchallenged.
I want to go on one final tangent, and it is about Ed with the cowboy hat, or cowgirl hat, I guess, whatever you want to say. In the sub, when she is riding around with Ayn on her back, she goes, "Hee-heen!" And I thought this was just her laughing, but going back and looking at it again, it's not. It's a Japanese onomatopoeia. So that's a grammatical term that describes words that resemble the sounds that they are referencing. So meow sounds like the sound a cat makes. That is an onomatopoetic word. In Japan, animal and people sounds are called gizgaigo when they are written out this way. So some examples, in America, we say that a pig says oink. In Japan, it's boo-boo. And in America, we say a sheep says ba. And in Japan, it's me-me, which I actually like a lot better. And hee-heen is horse. So if you're watching the sub, in Japan, that's what a horsey says.
I like how Ed immediately decides, like, I will be the horse. Ayn will ride on my back, not the other way around, which is how, you know, other people might choose to think of it. Like, other people might cast themselves as the cowboy and, you know, your dog is the horse. But, like, Ed, of course, has to flip it around the other way.
I feel like I know some kids that wanted to be horses when they grew up. It's a valid desire.
I know human adults who want to be horses still to this day, but that's neither here nor there.
We get to hear Teddy Bummer's philosophy after all. He says his attempts at waking up the world were a commentary on capitalism without philosophy, needless colonization of planets, and the circulation of slanted media and tall buildings that symbolize the problems in our universe. And when he's being taken away by the police, he admits that his actions too were needless. It's something about watching Andy and Spike battle that just made him see that it's all pointless. And I guess he's going to jail in peace. This also supports the lore observation we made earlier that I think colonization in this universe happened too quickly. There's a bunch of real estate we see in previous episodes that is just like signage in the desert, land that never got bought up. And that tells us a lot about the world Cowboy Bebop takes place in. Like, the technology was made to populate these alien worlds, and we got so excited about it that we went way too hard, way too fast. And it must be a drain on some people. It must be causing harm somewhere to put this man psychologically in this place.
There's a quote from the sci-fi author William Gibson that I feel is really appropriate here. Like, he said, "The future is here. It's just unevenly distributed." So we have all of this amazing technology in Cowboy Bebop. We have hyperspace gates. We have, you know, all of these spaceships that can do the impossible practically. And yet we have all of these things like incredible poverty that we've seen, all of this unused land, you know, all of the incredible destruction that Earth is subjected to on the daily. We don't see that things are being done about that. We don't see that people are trying to solve the solar system's problems. We see that people are, you know, maybe making a profit. People are trying to live their daily lives. So it's still the way things are in our world today, where there is incredible opportunity and there's incredible technology, but there's also incredible disparity.
And that's a theme in a lot of Watanabe's works, as we've seen going forward. Carol and Tuesday had a lot of that, as did Kids on the Slope. And so it's really interesting that this episode ends with Andy becoming a samurai instead, right? When we're talking about those who are less fortunate versus those who have the privilege to kind of change who they are at a moment's notice and become something new, re-identify themselves. And so he becomes Musashi, which may be a nod to the next project Watanabe works on, Samurai Champloo. But what do samurai do in a world full of cowboys? And we get the assumption that, like, maybe he's going to chase down the bounty hunters. The system's unfair. He's going to cut them in half. Why become a samurai in this context? To your point earlier, Kate, we have this really great cinematic aspect to Cowboy Bebop. And there was a point in American film where many directors were inspired by samurai films, and that is why they made Westerns. The most significant one being Seven Samurai and the analogy to that Magnificent Seven. So this is a spaghetti Western. Andy turns a new leaf. He becomes a samurai. Obviously, there's a lot of joking going on here. But, you know, when you get down to it, these are stories about people who are pioneering. They're making a living. They're trying to make ends meet. They're not really fantastic stories of riches or luxury. They just are. And it's a good analogy to Bebop itself.
But that's the whole problem with Andy, is his whole thing is just rich boy bullshit. When you're asking why be a samurai in this world, I don't think he's thought about it at all. I think it's just the latest set of toys and the latest costume and alias and fun persona that he can afford to switch into. He has the privilege to code switch and to LARP when a lot of other people are stuck exactly where they are, like the Bebop crew is stuck. I don't think he is going to make the great changes in society that a samurai could make, just like he didn't make the great changes in society that a bounty hunter could make. Side note, if you enjoy a story like this, I was drawing big parallels to the Ox Venture podcast. It's a D&D podcast run by Outside Extra and Outside Xbox. You can also see it on YouTube. And there is a pirate character named Corazon de Baena, and he hides the fact that he is actually a rich heir. He doesn't want anyone to know. And people find out in this podcast when his dad, who is also super wealthy, decides it would be fun for him to be a pirate too, and just like goes out and buys all the pirate stuff. And it infuriates and embarrasses Corazon in the same way that Spike is infuriated and embarrassed that someone could just buy his way into this lifestyle. So check it out if you want another story of irritating rich people getting their comeuppance.
I'm now imagining Andy as a pirate. Like, he just has a wheel dartboard of like new costumes and jobs to pick, and he just selects one when one fails. You know, it's like, all right, what's the wheel gonna get me now? I'm a pirate this time. Goodbye, samurai garb.
The marketing team did all the research, obviously. Samurai is what the people want.
I think if Andy were to come back as a recurring character or got his own anime, that would have to be the bit, is him just trying on different personas and different like schoolboy fantasy jobs and seeing which ones he can pull off. And the answer is none. It's none of them. I spotted Mokachu, by the way, you guys. I spotted Mokachu this episode. I was very excited. Was there anything else that you guys spotted that you thought was particularly interesting before we go?
I really thought that the eye catch of the episode, you know, like the go to commercial break, being a Flash Gordon reference was awesome. As someone who didn't really grow up watching that show, but knowing of the homages that it was in, things like, you know, Star Wars is definitely inspired by Flash Gordon along with samurai films. So hence more Andy at the end. But that being there brought a little more joy to my old heart right now, more so than when I first saw it back in the early 2000s/late 90s. And the fact that I could point it out now and recognize it has actually brought me a little more joy that I'm like, oh, insert Captain America meme. I understood that reference gif. There you go.
We can't end an episode of Cowboy Funk without also alluding to all of Space Dandy, a true himbo fuckboy. Please tune in if you like this one. I definitely think it was a show that was maybe underrated at the time, but it was very ambitious in its design and the story it's trying to tell. And you just want to hate Dandy just as much. Sometimes
I need to put a flag right here and say that you cannot simultaneously be a himbo and a fuckboy. I don't think there's any such thing as a himbo fuckboy, because himbos are likable and they care about others and their lack of intelligence makes them endearing. If you're a fuckboy, you're manipulating the people around you, and the people around you tend to not like you. That's all. I don't think they belong next to one another.
But if you watch Space Dandy, he is one day and the other another day.
I guess if it's himbo or fuckboy, depending on the day, I could buy that. I just don't think you're never both at once.
Please tell me I'm not the only one here.
Drop it. That's the end of the episode. It ends there. All right. It has been so amazing having you all here. I've loved personally talking to another podcast because there are just things that each of us are going to find and takes that each of us are going to have that are truly unique. And so if our listeners wanted to listen to your show or get to know any of you better, where would you like them to go?
For our podcast, you can find us on our website, vintageanimeclub.com. All our episodes are posted pretty much everywhere podcasts can be found, with the exception of SoundCloud and Spotify. And if you just search Vintage Anime Club, you know, wherever search engine you want to use, you should find us that way. But for ourselves, I post online under Ichnob, that's ICHNOB, both Twitter and Instagram. Currently, I am going through a Space Battleship Yamato / Star Blazers 2199 watch for the first time. So I'm excited to check that show out, and we'll be posting my watch through on Twitter.
So I'm not doing anything particularly entertaining these days, but I'm on Twitter at Taikochan, TAIKOCHAN. And the same on Instagram, except it's Taiko.chan.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at BlackRiku. That's BLKRIKU. And I also write for the online publication Black Nerd Problems, so you can check out my articles there.
Thank you for joining us today on this episode of the Bebop Beat. Thanks to Vintage Anime Club Podcast for being our guests today. Join us next week as we talk about the board games of Cowboy Bebop.
Thank you for listening to the Bebop Beat. If you like our show, please rate us on Apple or wherever you find your podcasts. Find us on Instagram and Twitter at Bebop Beat. Our email address is bebopbeatpodcast@gmail.com.
The Bebop Beat is hosted and produced by Jamie Sanchez and Lauren Fates. Our editor and associate producer is Angela Geis. Our logo and art assets are by Kat Janda. No, the marketing team.
No.
No. Me.
Okay, you. Okay, Jamie.